Robert Plant there with Let the Boogie Woogie Roll, backed by Jules Holland's Rhythm and Blues Orchestra. And before that, we were listening to, listening to Eddie and the Hot Rods' Teenage Depression from A Good Time Ago. And before that, we had Doctor Doctor by UFO and the Motors playing You Beat the Hell Out of Me. Tonight on the show, I'm going to have a bit of a look at permaculture, which, as a sort of long-time gardener, is rapidly turning out to be one of the things that I think is perhaps one of the more practical solutions that we can come up to some of the problems we face, at least sort of whilst trying to deal with the ground-based part of things. There's perhaps a limit to what we can do to the nature of the air and the water that's being pushed upon us. But nonetheless, I think it's helpful to start looking at some techniques which are seriously endeavouring to devise systems which are going to help us one way or the other to build more sustainable and more livable systems. I don't think when I'm talking to TNS Radio or Scottish Sovereigns on the Land, or indeed many of the people who've got these radio players across the internet, that I need to go into too much detail about the failure of vision that we're currently experiencing on planet Earth. We're many of us aware that old solutions that were sorted out by our ancestors have seemed to work, as my guest last week, Melanie, put it, for eons, and yet now they're being deemed to be no longer useful. The old ideas are seemed, and old solutions are somehow seen as no longer valid. And yet the new solutions often seem to repackage the old. Once again, this is something that we all come across day in, day out in our lives, but perhaps one of the most useful and easily grasped examples is the idea that for many, many years medicinal herbs were being used to heal all sorts of problems and diseases within the human being. Many of them even things that challenge us today, like neurological diseases and such like. And we know from investigations into old monasteries and things that are found in unpleasant parts of the ground around such places that homeopathy and herbal medicine have been practiced, and for years, eons, as she said. And my own experience of such things is that they work really well. And of course, what the modern world seems to have done is to identify that these things do work, to identify and look at the results that are being got from people eating plants or taking tinctures or whatever it is. And they're then synthesizing what they regard to be the active ingredient in these medicinal herbs and hiving them away, if you like, from all the other supporting minerals and effects that might be in the original plant, and coming up with pharmaceutical medicines. So somehow we are successfully moving ourselves from a position where things work really pretty well for us to a position where they don't really work very well at all. Another example might be the bizarre, but I'm sure basically right, 5-a-day campaign trying to get people to eat fresh vegetables and fresh fruit at least several times a day, whilst at the same time poisoning most of the food that the people can easily get their hands on. So all of this is, I think those two are clear examples of a failure of vision, and they don't need to outline anymore. But one of the areas where this failure, if you like, is very apparent, in my opinion, is in agriculture and food production. It's something that we appear to have lost control of a long time ago. There's a lot of discussion nowadays in many internet forums and also on TNS at times in the chat boxes about the time when we apparently inherited what is basically a Babylonian religious system, a system of myths and tales that were designed to deal with another part of the world and another time entirely, and yet they have become absolutely embedded in our culture. Well, at the same time, we seem to have embedded the Babylonian farming system. If you look at pictures of Eastern Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, these ancient sites, and you look at photographs on the internet now of the land surrounding them, they look very much like the lands in the UK. There's sort of seem to be wide open spaces, up until recently looking pretty dry, not here anymore, surrounded by enclosures of one sort or another. And it's often pointed out that in those areas there would once have been pretty much uncontrolled forests, lots and lots of wildlife, and it's all kind of gone. I think that had we followed our own ilk as it was in the dim and distant past, we would have probably concentrated on developing trees and shrubs, nuts and berries and fruits and the like, because that is what this natural ecosystem was originally. but somehow we've taken it over and replaced all of this wealth of stuff that would have been here, a huge variety of intermingling and interdependent species, with a whole set of monocultures within the fields and within the field margins. There's now very, very limited variety. And that means that kind of whole areas are used just for, say, growing one crop, whereas if you had the original forest there, there would have been within that area many, many different species of critter and plant living. We also, of course, turn across a lot of our soil and a lot of our growing space over to biomass and growing fuel. There's growing lots and lots of food for non-human stock, which uses up a lot of calories and yields very few. And there's, of course, nowadays, you can even get subsidised, I gather, for having windmills and phone masts and all sorts of other things on your land, which means that you don't have to provide any food at all. In fact, most of the subsidies that are now provided to farms are provided in many cases for not producing any food at all. And this is now affectionately known as slipper farming, because I guess you don't have to get out there and get your feet dirty. Currently, the last statistics I saw suggested that the income for your average farm, and I'm not sure how that's determined, of course, is something like £30,000 a year in the UK. Of that, about £7,000 is directly earned, and some £23,000 is subsidy from Europe. And this system currently uses about 10 calories of energy for every one calorie it actually supplies to people to eat. And whilst organic techniques would reduce this deficit, because agribusiness as currently set up uses a lot of pesticides and a lot of fertilizers, and without those you could reduce the energy intensivity of the farming a little bit, because currently we're doing things like sucking nitrogen out of the air and then putting it on the fields and Lord knows what else. Also, my own experience of seeing this farming being practiced shows that it's destabilizing, and it's not at all in harmony with the natural systems that it's trying to co-inhabit with. So, for example, one might see a sheep field that's full of grass and thistles and the like, and every now and then, after a given number of years, a farmer will turn up and he will weed kill the entire field so that it can then be ploughed up and have more grass sown on it, all of which is pretty distressing to the land, breaks up the soil structure, loses whatever strength you had in your original grass by killing it all off entirely. And I think worst of all, certainly in a lot of the fields in Wales, this is done in such a way that the major problem weeds such as docks and thistles don't really die off, but they seem to survive the killing and then they go to seed. And of course, basically you get the same problem as you had before. You get a pretty much a weed-filled field. In addition to this, all of the nitrogen, and we see loads of it being dragged about. I mean, you just lorry loads of huge bags of white powder that are going to get sprinkled on the land or sort of spread over it in the early spring. And it's put down purely and simply, as far as I can tell, to bring the grass on for 2 or 3 weeks earlier than it would otherwise have come about. So in other words, they're just trying to bring the feeding season forward a little bit. And whether or not the stuff works is entirely dependent, or more than partially dependent, on the weather, whether it rains or not. Again, not in doubt recently, but certainly in the past, you could see it going down and not raining. And also, it floats in the air. So if you're walking along a ridge or something and this kind of activity is going on below you, you can actually see the clouds of nitrogen or nitrates floating down the valley in whatever breeze there is. So all of this is a pretty futile and destructive way of going about things, and we appear to be turning out very little food, and what food we are turning out appears to be at least to a greater or lesser extent inedible or not good for us. At the other end, before we got into industrial farming, the closest thing we can describe or see in the world now is a sort of a much more drudge-laden peasant agriculture, which can potentially yield 10 calories of energy for every one calorie it uses up in energy to, you know, because there's less food distribution necessary and there's less machinery involved. But the other side of it is that all of that energy is coming directly from the labor of the person farming the land and the individuals that help and all of the beasties that put their effort in. And nowadays it's difficult to imagine that we could go back to or support such a system with so many people. So it seems that according to orthodoxy, we might just be staring at a choice between either high energy production and a life tending oxen and weeding and seeding and reaping crops, which even I, who've done quite a bit of it in my time, would not fancy doing for my whole life or on a full-time basis. But it's a change that would be, at best, weather-governed drudgery, and for many people it would be impractical and unacceptable. Permaculture was a phrase that was devised originally as a kind of a joining of part, the first part of permanence and the second part of agriculture. So we were imagining a kind of permanent agriculture, and it uses many ideas and skills that are not unique simply to permacultural practice. It encompasses farming techniques. Some of them are ancient, some of them are modern. It employs science and checking what's going on and trying to see how things are moving forward as a result of changes that are being made. Any new technologies that become available and are suitable will also be taken on board. So it recognizes very much the potential for solar power in helping the cultivation of food and the development, the proper sensitive development of the countryside. And permacultural systems are based closely and modelled on existing ecosystems as they're observed by, you know, the people of the world, I guess. And this is the way people's used to deal with their agriculture, I think, possibly when populations were a bit smaller and when people had their own ideas. There was a tendency to look at the way one's natural ecosystem grew and developed and to try and model one's own systems on that. And the result of that in some parts of the world was quite spectacular. There's a heightened variety that's offered by the environment, which is utilized by a forest, for example. So you've got a high canopy of tall trees and then a lower canopy of smaller trees. There'd be large shrubs and small shrubs, and then a kind of ground layer and herbs. And also there's even under the ground, of course, really, because some roots are edible and useful, and many of them are beneficial to the other plants and shrubs around them. So just imagine what it would be like if an area, say, the size of these large wheat fields was actually covered with this multi-layer of production, if you like, multi-layers of different plants, each supporting each other, and maybe many of them producing food either for the creatures that are living in the forest or for the human beings. And this is one of the things that permaculture is aiming for. It's aiming to kind of mimic some of this activity. And in fact, one of the things that I really enjoyed about permaculture is a separate subject, but it's kind of enclosed within it. And that is the subject of forest gardening, which aims absolutely to mimic what I've just described, that one way or the other, by attending to one plant and by introducing a bit of another one and having everything next to where it needs to be, you can slowly but surely change the shape of the natural environment so that it is more supportive of the humans and the other helpful creatures that are around. And I think this was something that the ancient Maya practiced before, I guess, population pressures and climactic pressures forced them to adopt a more slash and burn approach, was that it's been discovered that the forest around modern Maya settlements, many of which are based close to or more or less on the older settlements, within the forest there's a much, much higher proportion of useful trees and plants than might be expected had the forest just developed of itself. So it's clear that the ancient Maya were looking at the useful things that were going in the forest, and they were trying to attune their own life to the forest and attune the forest life to them. And to a certain extent, this lasted for a long time. Even when they were doing slash and burn, in fact, they would probably cultivate a patch of land for, say, a given 2 or 3 years, and then leave it to regenerate to a certain extent and go back to its wild state before coming back and trying to farm it again. So there was a kind of off and on principle which is just not apparent in our agriculture. And perhaps it's because of Darwinian conditioning, which constantly affirms that it's the survival of the fittest as a basic rule that is determining who's going to do what and what's going to succeed. We assume sort of automatically, I think most of us, that the law of the jungle is red in tooth and claw, and that in essence what we're looking at between species is competition. And competition is, I think, much presented to us as the natural way in which wild species interact, and it certainly seems to be presented as the way in which we should interact. But in fact, cooperation is just as important, or perhaps even more important than the competition. I think both energies kind of lead things forward. But I was particularly struck recently when on a bit of a nature walk around one of the farms in Mid Wales, we were being visited by a man called Ray Woods, who is an expert lichenologist and can actually talk for hours just about tiny patches of meadow and pasture and the like. He really is a fascinating man. And whilst I knew that all the trees of a given sort in a forest or a wood are actually connected by mycelia, little fungal runnels that connect them all under the earth, so that really every single offspring is still attached to its parent, and these mycelia seem to carry information as well as micronutrients and various other things, as well as keeping one tree in touch with another, I guess. But according to Ray Woods, when he was talking about a patch of ancient meadow we were looking at, all of the plants that were in there are attached to one single matrix of mycelia. So there's a kind of fungal network of information and nutrients supplying all of the plants in these wild and ancient places, and they're far from ensuring that the big and sturdy plants overrun the ones that need a little less nutrient and a little less space. The whole thing seems to maintain itself in balance. Everything is corresponding with everything else, and what we're looking at is a genuinely cooperative community of the vegetable world. And of course, this is what would have covered many parts of the so-called United Kingdom in the past, and it's all gone now. And it is Ray's opinion that it can't really be brought back. But I think it's still worth noting that systems do have a remarkable tendency to regenerate if you take away difficult or challenging circumstances. Bruce Lipton, I think, has said on the Dr. Rock show, and he said something similar on Jack's show as well, that basically if you put a bunch of cells in a petri dish and you put around them a bad or difficult environment, then they will shrink and they won't grow, they will lose their health and vitality. But as soon as you change the environment, the cells can once again start growing and becoming healthy. And the whole system, it seems to me, is designed to work like that. So what I'd like to do is now play a conversation that I had a couple of weeks back with Ros Brown of the Mid Wales Permaculture Network. And it's a light-hearted but fairly detailed kind of chat about Ros's current home and about her discovery of permaculture, which I think happened fairly recently within the last 2 or 3 years. So I've been able to watch the development of the patch of land that she's experimenting on. And it's become so much more than just a personal interest to Ros, so much more than just activity in her own garden. And another thing that I've been really enjoying is the Mid Wales Permaculture newsletter, which as time has gone by has expanded itself really from just purely permacultural issues to many other things. But I'm going to play that conversation now and then probably come back with a couple of tunes. And then have a look at one or two of the principles that make permaculture particularly important and versatile and usable really by every single one of us. I hope you enjoy the chat. I'll come back to you obviously a bit later. Nanath Ganol with Ros, who is the originator of the Mid Wales Permaculture Network and maintainer of the website and things. And I'm here basically to talk with you about sort of how you got here, really, and how it all started for you. Were you growing food before you came to Mid Wales?
Yeah, I suppose I've been growing food for 40 years, really, in one way or another. But before we came here, we were on the south coast in Devon, in a microclimate with no frost, balmy breezes, very good soil, and everything grew really, really well. So I thought I was a really good gardener until I came here.
Yes, yeah, Wales is a bit more of a challenge. What sort of place were you growing veg in Devon?
Free-draining, fertile, sandy loam, with very benign climatic conditions and lots of shelter.
Yeah, so that makes it really, it makes it easy to make sure that things are watered but not over-watered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what did you find when you came here to start with?
Well, basically that we were faced with a hillside of mineral soil where there were 100-year-old defunct ant hills. So it was just like dust, with big slaty flat rocks underneath it. So, yeah, it wasn't the most easy place to actually dig or make a garden.
And it's a fairly steep slope, isn't it?
So, yeah, it's at least 30 degrees.
Yeah, so everything had just been washing off. Had the place been left for that 100 years whilst the ants had been here?
Oh, yes. Nobody had lived here for 100 years, we know that, until about 12 years before we came. It had been turned into a holiday let after it was renovated. And it had been ruined. The house had been a complete ruin since the early part of last century, of the 20th century.
When was it built, just as a matter of interest?
1556.
So it was situated here when people knew where to put places.
Yes.
Why do you think they chose here, given the challenging nature of the land as it stood?
Well, that always used to puzzle me until I learned a lot more about it. And interestingly, I learned quite a lot about these sorts of sites when I was doing the permaculture training, because it's a classic elevation site for this part of the world. It's halfway down the hill. It's on a slight plateau, and it's above the floodplain, but below what they call the Freith, which is the oak woods higher up the hill. Mm-hmm. So it's a good place for people to farm, particularly with cattle, which they would have had here originally. So in the winter, during the day, the cattle would be down in the fertile fields, providing they weren't flooded. They could also grow a certain amount of crops like barley and mangels to feed the livestock down there because it's fertile. It's not too far to bring the cattle in at night, which they did because of the cattle rustling being rife in medieval times. And then during the summer, the cattle would go up on the tops, and they had a summer dairy up at the top, and the ruins of that are still there. Right. So then they could bring the dairy products back down the hill quite easily.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it?
And the other important thing about it is it's away from the frost pockets. So the frost gets the hill at the top and it gets the slopes down at the bottom. But we are in this condition in the middle on the spring line where we are mostly frost free except in extreme weather conditions in the winter.
Which is extraordinary, isn't it, really? So the frost kind of falls down on the top of the hills and it also rolls down into the valley.
Yeah.
But the sort of plateau here, and presumably you've done a bit of planting, have you, to kind of stop the frost rolling down off?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so that's right out. And perhaps you might like to explain for people just a little bit about what permaculture is for any listeners that are not familiar with it.
Yes, it's always a difficult question, especially when you've got a short time to answer it.
Well, we've got time, unless you're in a hurry.
Permaculture isn't just about how you grow your garden. It's really a design system for sustainable living on a crowded planet. So it's to do with the design of sustainable human settlements and everything to do with that. So it might be to do with how you organise your community, your business, your buildings, your energy, as well as how you grow your food.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the basic principles are presumably to try and reduce the amount of waste you make and...
Yeah. Yeah, ideally you design your system to be as closed loop as possible so that you don't have useful stuff leaching out of it, whatever it is that you're looking at.
Yeah.
And it takes all its principles from observation of nature and ecology. So these are things that we can observe in nature and learn from, because nature doesn't waste things. It is a closed-loop system and everything works in a sustainable way if we don't mess it up. So we take our principles from looking at nature, but it differs from plain organic gardening and other kinds of sustainability because it's also built on a platform of ethics. And the ethics are threefold. They're to do with earth care, people care and fair shares.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good summary. Good things to be aiming for. Mm. So you had a house that had effectively been fully restored. Was it occupiable?
Yeah, pretty much. It had been restored as a holiday let, which isn't necessarily entirely suitable for permanent occupation. But we've got to grips with some of that, and we've changed certain things about it. We had a barn, which was really just a shell that we have done things with, and we had what used to be a byre in the garden that had also been made into a little guest cottage.
And is staying as a guest cottage, but the barn's been turned into something that can support your horticulture, really.
Yeah, it has been. There was an upstairs room at one end of the barn which had been the hay store, and it had been used as a games room when it was a holiday let. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is turn that into a kind of studio activity area, learning space that's fully insulated, so it needs hardly anything to keep it heated. So it's a very useful space for doing creative things in, and also for sharing with groups of people who come to see the garden or come to learn something on a workshop.
And have you been using the education kind of process and the people coming along to help do the work in the garden?
We don't as such have people come and help like they would with a woofer system, for example. But when people come on a course, we like to engage them in some kind of practical activity.
Yeah.
People do get involved and help build a new section or do some clearing or do some planting sometimes.
So they get a bit of practical experience, and you get a bit of the workload distributed.
Yeah.
And nonetheless, it's clear to me, and I've watched it happening for a while now, it's clear that a lot of work has gone in to the place. What was growing here when you arrived?
There were a lot of brambles in certain places. There was a whole area of garden which is now our soft fruit area that even the previous owners didn't know what was in there. And there were the remains of an old wall, a lovely Welsh wall, built out of great big stones like gravestones. And that helped us to really find out where the original parts of the garden might be that they had grown their own vegetables in and kept chickens and that sort of thing. And that was all in a dense thicket of mostly blackthorn and brambles and hazel. And so we actually cleared that part out and established a soft fruit area on that part of the slope. That was the very first thing that we did.
And was there soil still there? Because presumably they must have established...
Yeah, it's the only part of the garden that actually had rich soil because it had retained all the leaf mould that had come down off the Frith over 100 years and been caught up in all this undergrowth.
Yeah.
So actually we were deluded by that in the beginning and thinking we'd got really good soil. And what we found was that was the only area that actually had it. So it was a real lesson in what you have to do to actually stop all this good stuff just disappearing off the site all the time.
Because the earlier occupants who were farming all those years ago would presumably have developed a garden for growing vegetables in.
They would have been very self-sufficient here.
So at some point there would have been quite a lot of soil retained by these big stones and the rest of it, and it had all gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Once you got rid of your delusions, planted up the bit that was easy and started discovering what was the rest of the garden, what was the first thing you did?
We knew we would have to do something about growing on the hillside because the lower part of the garden was a bit more formal and it was just mown grass with borders of perennials and shrubs, flowering stuff that had been put in by the previous owners for easy maintenance while it was a holiday let, so it could be managed by, you know, one man in a mower once a week. So we didn't really want to disturb that too much because that was very pretty and near the house. But above that, there was this whole completely unused section of quite sloping ground, as I say, with lots of old, very old derelict anthills. And the only things that grew here really were blackthorn, brambles and couch grass. There was no evidence of what we call in permaculture succession on that section at all. It was just all open. It had a few daffodils come up in the spring, and the rest of it was just couch grass. Nothing else had been able to move in and colonise that area in all that time. And that's really unusual. And it tells you a lot about how impoverished it was.
Yeah, because what we'd expect to happen is we'd expect kind of nursery plants, wouldn't we? Small, short-lived trees to establish themselves, to do exactly what you're describing, to drop leaf mould, keep it there, and then bigger trees arrive. And but none of that at all.
No,
all
nothing.
All you've got, in fact, is difficult things to remove and rampant things, brambles and blackthorn, and very difficult and aggressive to deal with.
Yeah. So even the blackthorn and the brambles hadn't actually colonised the big central area that is now our main growing area. They had not managed to do anything with it. So I don't know why I thought I was going to be able to initially.
Well, from the look of it, it certainly succeeded.
Yeah, it's what we decided to do in the end, having tried to dig into this and found that you can't get a fork into it. I mean, if we have to dig a hole to put a tree in, it's a pickaxe job.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult because all these pieces of slaty stone are flat and they all kind of overlap and you just can't get in there at all. And the only soil that is in mixed in with that is just like mineral dust, and it doesn't have any organic material to speak of, and it doesn't hold moisture. So we did lots of tests on that and really decided it wasn't a goer. So in that situation, really, you've only got one choice. You've got to build up. And because we're on such a big slope, the main growing area is on terraced beds. So we actually began to make terraces in our hillside.
And did you just build up at the front, or did you use the picks to dig into the back a little as well?
Well, we built up at the front initially, and we used a lot of very old, wormy-looking oak beams that were all lying about in the barn that had come out of the house originally, or the barn, and been too far gone to be used when they were renovating. And they were all just still there, lying around. So we took all, we did try cutting them up and burning them, and they just smoulder, they don't burn. So even though they're really old and wormy-looking, they are still like steel, you know.
Yeah.
So we carried them all up the hillside, and we used those as the fronts of the new terraces. And initially, we just tried adding a bit of compost on top and trying to create a growing medium, and it didn't work at all.
What was it that foxed that?
There just wasn't enough soil depth, and there wasn't enough nutrients. And the couch grass kept encroaching from the pathways at the back of the beds, and so we decided the next year the only thing to do was actually raise the height, which meant putting another wooden framework on top of these beams. So we also had a raised edge at the back of each bed as well, to separate it from the next pathway, and then to gradually acquire and build up enough compost or topsoil to be able to get started with that.
So did you have to bring a lot of material in for that?
Yeah, we did initially have to bring some in. We were lucky to get some soil improver from Coombe Harry at Newtown, which doesn't exist anymore, but did then, and we're doing great stuff with composting municipal green waste and food waste. And this stuff was like rocket fuel. You had to mix it with other compost because it was too strong. But that at least got some oomph into it. We also began to collect leaf mould, because we get a lot of leaves come down off the freeth as well as what falls off our own trees, and it ends up, you know, on our land at least a part of the season. So we began to collect that in huge amounts and build leaf cages to actually compost that down.
And that's fairly nutrient poor, isn't it?
You need other stuff with it.
Yeah, but it's really good at retaining moisture.
It
does have some basic elements in it that are useful for growth.
And it's got lots of very active microbes and all that sort of thing, which you really want. So we've got bracken on site as well, so we began to compost that.
Yeah.
And we're also now composting it with sheep's wool, which we get from the farmer next door.
Because it's quite surprising to people perhaps, but even quite a small raised bed takes an enormous amount of stuff to stuff it with.
Huge amount, yeah.
And every year as well, because of course the vegetables and the food and the plants as they grow, the soil level drops, doesn't it?
It drops, by 3 or 4 so you've inches. Got to keep topping it up. So we're now using our own garden compost from, you know, all the waste stuff that we compost, kitchen waste and garden waste. So we now, that's going well enough to have enough to top up the nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, beg, borrow and steal manure wherever we can get it, if we know that it's come from a place that isn't contaminated by any nasty sort of grass control agents or anything like that.
Yeah, and is that in plentiful supply, kind of in the immediate locale, or do you have
Just have to get to know your neighbours, really.
Yeah, and keep your eyes open for large piles of steaming poo.
Yeah, except you don't want it from anywhere that it might have been contaminated, because there's a big scare last year where several people that we know got manure from a source that they thought was okay, and then all their plants died, and it turned out to be this thing called aminopyralate, which is it's a chemical that's used in some pastures to control certain weeds. And it gets into the grass that the horses eat. It doesn't hurt the horses, but it passes through them into their dung. And it, because it's a herbicide, if it's present at all in the manure that you put in your garden, it will then kill all your own plants. They just go yellow and die and become deformed, and it's just horrific.
I really didn't know about that.
So there's quite a lot on the internet about that, and we've got stuff on our website about it.
Mm.
So it really is important that you verify your sources of manure, and you don't just think, oh, well, you know, you've been offered some, let's just go and get it.
So it doesn't necessarily need to be organic, but it does, and
You've got to be sure that the people have not sprayed their pasture land with herbicides. Yeah.
Really any important. Of the herbicides?
I would avoid any herbicide stuff, because we try to be organic here.
Yeah.
We're not certified or anything, obviously, because we're not producing commercially, but we don't want to use anything here that might be contaminated with something unpleasant.
And how commonplace is the non-use of herbicides? I would have thought
We get stuff from our neighbour from time to time, and he is certified organic, so we know he's okay.
Yeah.
And if we get stuff from people, other people who just keep horses, particularly if it's not their own land they keep horses on, we have to just really make sure that, you know, nothing else has gone into it. So, you do have to be careful. The other thing is keeping worms, which didn't do too well 2 years ago in the really nasty freeze-up. So I haven't got going on that again, but I'm going to next year, because that produces very, very high-quality additive for your liquid feed and, worm compost.
Yeah.
That you only need to mix a little bit in, and it actually will do the job.
So that makes quite a nice complement, really, with the leaf mould.
Yeah.
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 And also, once you've got a decent bed of soil for roots to go through, presumably In the stone and the slate and stuff, there's a fair amount of elemental nutrient in that for plants, isn't there?
There should be, but given the poor state of our site to begin with, the other thing I did add was rock dust.
Right.
And mycelium granules. So I've got a kind of special mix that I like to put together when I'm planting new stuff, particularly shrubs and fruit bushes and trees. I put seaweed meal, rock dust, mycelium and worm compost together, and mix it all up, and then add it, you know, sprinkle it into the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives everything a bit of a good start, and it helps to get the mycelium going, which are really important for your plant health and establishing proper living soil.
So, yeah, bringing the soil to life as well as putting it in.
Yeah.
And what plants did you start with?
I would think potatoes are a really good first salvo.
Mm.
And all the new beds that we've created, we've grown potatoes in first, because you can grow them in straw. So if you're building up from the ground, you can actually put potatoes into straw, and you can actually put cardboard mulch down to kill the weeds, plant the potatoes through it, put straw on top, and then you just, as the potatoes grow, you just earth them up with whatever you've got, basically grass clippings and all sorts of other anything to kind of bulk it up.
And mostly keep the light off the potatoes. Is it just for keeping the light off?
It keeps the light off the potatoes, yeah. And then when you've taken your potatoes out, a lot of that straw, all the cardboard's rotted down, it's killed all the weeds underneath, and you've actually generated soil. So you end up with a basis of new soil that's freshly created, lots of carbon in it. And you know, you can add bracken and all sorts of things under your cardboard, and the straw mixes in and gradually rots down as well. So that's a really good start for actually getting a new growing area ready.
And I mean, that suggests that you're actually successfully growing potatoes where there isn't necessarily a huge depth, just in your fairly, albeit shallow, albeit raised beds.
Yeah,
that's also news to me.
Yeah, you don't get huge crops, but it gives you a crop while you're also preparing an area for growing something a bit more the next year.
And it provides you with some more growing medium.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So potatoes first. Yeah. You've got a greenhouse as well, presumably use that to start things off.
Oh, yeah, I have to, because lots of things won't grow here at the beginning of the season. It's too extreme for them.
Yeah.
So I learned that, because when we first came, people said, oh, it's a very short growing season in this part of Wales. And I thought that meant that you had to get everything in early, which is completely the wrong way around.
It's short at both ends.
it starts
late and finishes early.
It's much worse at the beginning.
Yeah.
So now, in order to get a good start, most things, apart from things like root vegetables, like carrots, most things get started off in the greenhouse. They get hardened off in the cold frames outside, and then they go outside, and if necessary they get fleece over them as well, to get them going to begin with, in case we get any late frosts, you know, that might suddenly take you by surprise, even though we're fairly frost free. So that's the only way that I found that I can really get everything very productive, is to have that approach, and also to put second sowings in directly into the ground a bit later than you would otherwise think of doing. And then you get a really good crop going on into October, before the first sort of really cold weather comes.
So having got potatoes and that kind of provides you with some growing medium and stuff, what was and it wasn't all potatoes in the first year either,
potatoes. We got things like Swiss chard and pak choi, mostly things that grew on top rather than putting down great roots because of this depth problem that we had. But as I say, the first year, the results for everything else were not... This is before I got onto the growing the potatoes in the straw and all that sort of thing. Because the first year was before I'd done the permaculture training.
Right.
So I was feeling my feet and really getting very upset by the lack of good results, because I'd not been used to that at all.
And it is heartbreaking, isn't it, bringing stuff on in the greenhouse, planting it out and just watching it all shrivel. Were there any successes in that first year before the permaculture training? Was there anything that worked properly here?
No, not really.
No.
That's why I got very desperate. And it was at this point that someone sent me an email with a link to a film that had been on television called A Farm for the Future. And this was, I think it was Rebecca Hoskins. And I watched this film, and what it did was remind me about permaculture, because I had known about it in the past, but I'd never really kind of completely understood what it was about. Every time I'd seen people talking about it or exhibiting stuff about it, I thought what they're doing sounds really good. But I didn't really understand the basis for it. I just got little hints and tips, but not the whole thing. And I think what that documentary did was to make me realise that there was something in there that I could learn and use here. And so it was a tremendous spur. So I thought, well, we'll seize the moment. I looked on the internet to see if there were any courses available. And there was one coming up in Llanfyllin, up near Welshpool. So I rang up, asked about it, and got on the course. And then I went off with my tent for 2 weeks, which was quite a big thing for me, because I haven't camped for years. And it was fairly extreme, terrible weather conditions at the end of May that year. And we spent most of it, sort of, it was like trench foot and mud and, you know.
And here Wales we were.
Kind of trying to keep a roof over your head and learn from morning till night. It was very, very intensive, two weeks. And I came back with my whole concept of what we were trying to do here completely turned upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realised was that I'd got to really understand how this site worked, understand what was going on, and stop fighting it, and to actually work with it in a completely different way, and use the weeds as indicators to understand, and to not worry about actually what was growing here. Because we'd had this sort of fight couch grass thing, you know, going on. And it just changed everything for me completely. We had to kind of undo a few things that we'd thought we were going to do here, or tweak a few things and do them differently. But fortunately, I went on that course at a very pivotal point where it was still possible to make the site work without having to redo everything.
Right, because you hadn't been going... Well, I suppose after such a disappointing year, you hadn't had time really to make too much change.
No, no.
So you started using the things that were growing here naturally to give you some idea as to what would be easy to grow here.
Yeah, we had to really look at that. Interestingly, what I had realised was that we had no nettles at all. I'd never lived in a place before that didn't have stinging nettles. And I had remembered thinking, well, at least we don't have stinging nettles.
And it is rare.
And then all of a sudden I needed stinging nettles.
Because, of course, nettles tend to grow where humans have been.
Oh, yeah.
But that's because humans tend to improve the fertility of the soil, and they like fertility, don't they? So
they can always identify where the Roman latrines were from the air, because the nettles grow really, really well in those particular patches because they like the nitrogen.
If we're looking to site a composting toilet, we quite often head straight for the nettle patch on the assumption it's going to be easier to dig a hole there than it is anywhere where they're not.
Sure. And you can eat them. And you can use them for dye plants, and you can make rope out of them, and there's all kinds of lovely things.
Yes, yeah.
You can make garden sprays out of them as well.
Yeah, I've recently found you can eat the flowers from them as well.
Oh, really?
That's Synchro's latest discovery. We've been making soup out of nettle tips for ages, and obviously keeping nettles cut so that you've constantly got the young tops. But she's discovered now that The long flowers that come off them, they can be eaten in soups as well, and they can also be dried, and they're full of good stuff.
The nettle tea.
Or eaten. They're kind of quite nutty.
That's something to try.
So I'm looking forward to, you know, we get the nettle tips in the spring, and we'll be getting the nettle flowers now as well. She's going around eyeballing them all.
What I noticed, I mean, it really bears it out, was that when we did start to get nettles, the only places they grew were where the peas and beans had grown season before.
Is that the
because they put
fixing?
The nitrogen into the soil and the nettles like that. So that was really interesting.
And did the peas and beans grow well in the first year?
Not as well as I would have liked them to grow, but they're doing quite well now. We find that we grow peas here very, very easily. Mm-hmm. Beans are much more of a challenge, and it's often because if you put them out too early here, they get buffeted by very, very high winds very early on, and they don't like it. At all, and it tends to weaken them, and then they tend to shrivel up and die. So that's the other thing I've learned, that is put the beans out much later than I would have ever done anywhere else.
And you are, of course, putting in some windbreaks, aren't you?
Yeah, lots of gorse.
Yeah, which grows very easily here.
Yeah, that's done really well.
Does it have any advantages apart from its windbreakness?
Yes, it's a nitrogen fixer because it's a legume.
I didn't know that.
It makes fantastic mulch. If you do have livestock, you can bruise it and use it for fodder as well. They used to have a kind of thing like mangle that you put the gorse through to sort of, you know, make it slightly less spiky.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently sheep will eat it straight off the bush in very hard winters.
Right.
And they used to measure the hardness of the winter by the amount of little blood spots around the muzzle of a sheep.
Okay. Amazing reading your environment. Yeah. I seem to remember being fed gorse flowers at some point as well.
Yeah, I haven't tried them, but you can make tea from broom flowers, can't you? So I don't see why it shouldn't work with gorse.
No.
They're all pea family. Mm. And that was really good for the bees, and because they it's a very long flowering season with gorse. There's always something got flower on it.
Yeah.
So that's really good for bees and other pollinators.
Yeah. And what else did we go for apart from peas and beans and potatoes?
Well,
was there anything unusual that the permaculture suggests led you to grow that you wouldn't otherwise have grown?
Yeah, Oriental mustard greens did really great, and until 2 years ago when the winter got really hard, the rabbits actually didn't eat them. They only ate them when they got really desperate. And mustard greens, they sound a bit horrendous, but actually when you cook them, all the hotness goes out of them, and they're just like really nice green stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew Osaka Purple and Green Wave. Those were the most successful, and they kept going. Particularly the Green Wave was really, really good through the winter.
Outside?
Outside, mm, yeah. They will actually grow here in Wales in the winter.
Brilliant, because I know a lot of the Oriental greens will grow in polytunnels and greenhouses through the winter, but something that will grow outside.
Green Wave is good. You can grow it during the summer, but what I do is I wait till other things are cleared away, and that'll be my last sowing for the winter, and then we'll have a crop of green stuff that will see us through until the next year.
Do you have much other stuff that you can still crop in the autumn and winter here?
Yeah, I've got now growing an evergreen sorrel, which will keep going. This year I'm going to try green in the snow mustard greens, because they're supposed to be really good in extreme conditions. I've got some perennial kale and some tree collards going, and they keep going through the winter, and they'll keep going forever.
Yeah. And do they stay where the perennial kale and stuff, do they stay where they are? You don't move them, they just
stay where they are. Yeah, and you take root cuttings to propagate, because they don't produce flowers, so they don't actually seed or anything.
Okay.
So you have to, it's a bit specialist, but I'm going to have a go at that this year.
Yeah. And even when they're old plants, they still produce tender leaves.
Apparently about tree collards will go on for about 20 years. They're the ones that look like walking sticks with cabbage on the top.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah, I know the ones.
So that'd be good for us because of the rabbits.
Yeah.
So hopefully they won't be able to reach.
Yeah. Mm. I don't remember hearing about the rabbits when I came here before. They've been a trial right from the beginning.
Apparently it was famous for, if you wanted to go rabbiting, this is where you came.
Right.
And of course it was empty for such a long time. I think they got a bit of a hold.
Yeah.
And we say we have weir rabbits up here. I mean, they're mental. And the first year we put all the new fruit trees in, and the snow was very high, we didn't realise that they could then get up above all the rabbit guards we'd put round the trees, and they ring barked about five of our new trees and killed them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do have to take the rabbits into account.
Rabbits, I'm told, in a really hard winter can actually kill quite mature trees, because when they can't find anything else, they'll eat the bark
off
big old trees and kill them as well.
They were even taking the bark off the wormwood, and you've got to be desperate to do that.
Certainly have, yeah.
Because it's very bitter. Yeah.
This is all really learning from observing your own environment and constantly being caught off guard by it.
Totally, yeah.
So by the end of the first year, you had a reasonable variety of stuff.
We just didn't have it in great quantities. And things like the root vegetables, parsnips all forked because of the stones.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we just knew we'd got to build up the soil depth, really, in order to get good crops. And I would say last year and this year are the first years that we've had where everything is doing what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. But this year, because things like the cucumbers all died outside, whereas before they'd been really good.
It was, in fact, the worst of all worlds, wasn't it? Because we had a long hot spell in March, which made everything think that it was okay, and then it just rained and rained for weeks.
And all the blossom didn't get fertilised because there weren't any bees around, because the blossom came too early. And so this year's been pretty mixed up. And
that was because the bees were sheltering rather than because they aren't here, because I've been I've seen more bees here than I've seen anywhere else.
Yeah, they just
year.
Didn't come out because of the weather, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's been a bit of a funny year. Every year we seem to get some new challenge, you know, but
I suppose the challenge always provides new information, though, does it?
It does, yeah. Yeah, you have to watch things, but I think that because of the amount of climate chaos that we're having now, I defy anybody to really get round all that and be prepared for everything. And because you can't be, you know, every time you think you've got something sussed and you do something slightly differently, or you put more protection measures in place, something else happens to kind of mess it up.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I've done this year is not to put any of my eggs in one basket. So I'm going more and more towards what we call polycultures, which is where you mix stuff up together or you grow it in small patches all over the place and you try to put them next to things that they like being next to, companion planting.
Yeah.
But you don't, for example, have all your carrots in one place or all your parsnips in one place or all your brassicas in one place. You actually have, you know, sort of 2 foot square patches of things in about 4 different locations. So if one lot gets wiped out, the others are still okay.
Yeah.
And you don't plant them all at the same time either. Mm-hmm. You kind of stagger your sowing and your planting out.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you're not so vulnerable to either climatic changes or insect pests or other things that might go wrong.
And that in itself, as well as giving you a better chance of actually getting to eat some of your vegetables, is also, if you're planting it in 4 different places, you're getting 4 times as much information, aren't you?
Oh, yeah,
you get
sure.
to learn a lot yeah. more from it.
Yeah, and you think, well, you know, oh, this did really well here, and it didn't do so well there. Now, why is that? You know, so there's always things to learn.
And also, you can presumably you experiment with planting them with different companions in different places,
yeah.
not the same bundles of stuff.
Yeah.
I was interested that you obviously picked on the polyculture thing from an experiment that somebody was running because you were given the stuff to mix.
Yes.
And you said that initial experiment didn't go very well because of the mixture of plants. What sort of things were in?
Yeah, it's interesting because before I did that trial, I had a go at polycultures after being on the permaculture training because it's one of the things that you learn about. But it is all fairly experimental and a fairly recent concept, so nobody's got all the answers. So when I came back from the course, I didn't have all the things to hand that they talked about on the course as being, you know, this is a good polyculture mix. And it was a bit late in the season as well because it was the beginning of June. So I just had a go with what I had and it worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
And the things I grew in that patch outstripped the performance of all their fellows that had been planted all in their normal way in other parts of the garden. So that was really interesting. So when the Permaculture Association said they were going to run a trial and they wanted people to have some meetings to talk about how we might organise that, I went to it. And I ended up on the steering group, interestingly. Mm-hmm. Goodness only knows why, but, you know, just because of determination, I suppose. So we all kicked ideas around about what we'd done and what we could do as a trial with, say, 50 people and what seeds we could get from seed companies. And it was, you know, an elephant designed by a committee, really. It was, I don't think anybody was particularly happy with what we ended up with, but that's what we had anyway. And I had some misgivings about it, but I thought, okay, well, we'll give it a go and we'll follow the instructions and we've all got to do the same thing, except that, you know, the way that we actually plant stuff is kind of up to us. It's all right, it's just the usual Hercules bomber coming over. Mm.
It's amazing they're still flying around in those things.
I think they use it as a target practice.
Yeah. How many of us are still driving around in Ford Anglias?
Yeah. So, anyway, I put all this stuff in and it was actually rather interesting. If I'd done it myself and had that result, I'd have been crushed, really, really disappointed. But because it was a trial and we were all being very scientific mm-hmm. and recording all our results and weighing everything we picked and, you know, being really, really good about it, it became rather fascinating. And I had the best rocket crop I've had in years. And the rocket completely took over. The next thing that took over were the kale plants. Did ever so well.
Yeah.
The peas actually struggled but managed to produce some. And nothing else really worked at all out of the mix of 12 things that we'd been told to put in.
Mm.
And so at the end of the season, we all put our results in. And people at the association correlated it and then put out the results. And what was interesting, we all had very, very similar problems. So obviously there were some factors involved in that which were to do with the actual combination of stuff
yeah.
and how much of it there was and what things shaded out other things and stopped them germinating and all that sort of stuff.
Because this is one of the basic principles of permaculture is to plant things together so that they gain advantage from each other,
It's one way of doing things, yeah.
yeah.
But actually mixing things up like a kind of miniature forest with different layers, you know, sort of short things, root things, tall things, mm-hmm. canopy things, it's like a miniature forest garden idea,
yeah.
but, you know, in a vegetable plot. And it can, as I say, work really well because I'd proved that to myself. But this mixture really was very, very problematic. So certain things did really, really well, and other things didn't work at all, which is not what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, whatever happens is a learning experience.
They do say that a failed hypothesis is more educational
exactly.
than a successful
but
one, don't they?
What became very, very clear is that most of the people doing this were relative beginners, or they had not done polycultures before, and they weren't necessarily very confident about identifying what was coming up in their plot or which things they ought to take out at what point to stop them taking over. So that was another very interesting fact that emerged, that beginners are not necessarily best equipped to work with mixed polycultures, mm-hmm. that it may be something that very experienced people can get fantastic results with, because they know exactly what they're looking at, and they know exactly what stage they should take things like the cover crops out,
yeah.
whether it's white mustard or rocket or some other thing that you just chuck over, you know, when you've planted all the other things.
Mm.
And if you don't do that, then it takes over and it makes it very difficult to see what's going on and to pull other stuff out at the right time.
Yeah. And anything that takes over is going to act to the disadvantage in terms of nutrients, water and
oh, yeah.
light
yeah.
of all the things
yeah,
around
exactly.
it. And rocket can go mad.
Yeah. Mm. So the rocket and the kale were very successful at the expense of most other things in the mixture,
yeah.
Which wasn't the intention at all. But, you know, we have learned from that. So following on from that, we're in the design stage of a new trial for 2013 now. And in the meantime, I decided to investigate what I would call block polyculture. Mel Bartholomew did a lot in the States with square foot gardening, which was a similar kind of idea. And it's a kind of combination of permaculture and French intensive gardening, where you grow stuff where all the leaves touch and it provides like a living mulch, keeps the moisture in, stops the weeds growing,
yeah.
And it's very intensively planted.
Yeah. It's also, I'd add now for the listeners, a very good way of starting vegetable gardening
mm.
is this square foot idea of you could have a sort of 4 foot by 4 foot bed
mm.
divided into 16 squares, each yeah. a foot round, and then put different things in each one. That's the basic
yeah,
idea, isn't
that's
it?
That's the idea, yeah.
yeah.
So what we did was we got together, I put together a demonstration bed exactly of that kind that we could take with us to events, because it's a really nice way to engage people when you're trying to run a stall that's labelled permaculture and people kind of drift past and they don't really know what it is. And it's like the question you asked me, what is permaculture?
Yeah.
It's very difficult to explain that
yeah.
in that situation.
Yeah.
So you need something that people can get a little idea from that catches their interest and where they can take it away and think, oh, I could do that.
Mm.
That's attainable.
Yeah.
So we got a fact sheet together about how to make the thing, what materials to use, exactly what you do, and what you could grow in it, and how many of any given vegetable you could put in a square.
Great.
Whether you plant the seeds directly or whether you plug plant it, all that kind of thing. And how, when you finish cropping one square, you put a bit more compost in and you plant something else that overlaps into the next season.
Mm-hmm.
So you get continuous production in a very intensive way. It's manageable. It really doesn't need weeding very much. You know exactly what should come up where, because you know how much you put in. So if something else comes up in that square, you know it's a weed, you take it out.
Now, that is a really good point. Again, as an experienced gardener, it doesn't necessarily... I forgot. I do remember now, when I started maintaining gardens, that a lot of the plants that you are actually trying to grow do tend to look a little bit like the ones that you're not
oh,
trying
yeah.
to grow. When you're gardening in somebody else's garden, it leads to real crises of confidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's true. So they get to be able to tell when the right thing's coming up.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a confidence builder. It helps people to not to have too much prior information. Children can do it. You can have a 3 foot square bed so they can reach all of it.
Yeah.
And apparently, if you have a square meter bed divided into 9 squares, you can produce in that enough for one proper serving of vegetables or salad every day for one person for an extended season. It's enough. You can have it on your patio. You could even have it, you could have a slightly different shape and have it on your balcony. It's easy. It doesn't have to be on the ground. You can have drainage holes with a base, and you can have it up on a movable platform or on, you know, something where a person in a wheelchair could access it, or an older person doesn't have to bend. You can keep it away from predators. You can even have a frame at the back fixed to it for growing peas or other climbers up.
You don't need too much stuffing to go in there to start it off.
No, it's not. It's not too big. You can have a 6-inch deep one.
Yeah.
And you can grow most things. If you want to grow something that requires more depth in one square, you can have an integral 12-inch box that just drops into that, so you could grow potatoes or carrots in
that's
that.
That's a good
in
idea
square.
Too. Yeah.
So it cuts down the overall amount of compost that you need. So. This idea really caught the attention when we were at the Spring Greens Fair in Hereford.
Brilliant.
We had so many people come by, and they took away the leaflets on how to do it, and people were saying, yeah, I could do this, and I could move it in a different part of the garden to catch the sun at certain times, and it would be really, really easy. You know?
Excellent. What a great thing to have done.
Yeah. And I've got one going in the garden here, which you've seen when we went round, and it's been so abundant. I've had so much stuff already.
Yeah.
And it'll just keep going, you know. It's and I've got a little frame made of plumber's pipe that I can either put a plastic cover over, or I can put butterfly netting over if I've got brassicas in it.
Yeah.
Enviro mesh or whatever to, you know, keep things off it.
Yeah.
Really, really easy to look after and maintain. And all you need is a trowel and a pair of scissors.
Yeah.
You don't even need any other gardening tools to do that.
And we might, what would we prefer the trowels to be made of?
Copper. Bronze, anyway.
Yeah, because of the electrical charge it leaves in the soil that
that's
the slugs
right.
really don't like.
Yeah.
And you've been using copper tools or for how long?
Well, after I did the permaculture course, I got really interested in people like Victor Schauberger, who was this Austrian man who did a lot of research on various things, including water and copper.
Yeah.
And he designed a copper plough, and they had very measurable, better results from growing in the ground and less pests and all that kind of thing. And lots of people probably know that you can buy copper collars to put around your plants at vast expense to keep the slugs off. They won't cross it because apparently their blood or their body fluid is based on copper and not on iron like ours. And this therefore creates a kind of electrical charge that deters them. So if you use copper tools or bronze tools, which are very high in copper, it leaves traces in the ground of copper, which they don't like, so they tend to not come near your veg. But the other important reason it works, apparently, is because if you use steel tools in the ground, because of the iron, it alters the magnetic patterns in the ground. And slugs, because they are not based on iron, are actually sensitive to that. So it's like you've drawn them a road map to all your new seedlings every time you disturb the ground, which is why they tend to go for newly planted stuff more than anything else.
Excellent.
So if you use copper tools, you're not disturbing any of these magnetic patterns in the ground at all, and they don't click that you've actually just put something new and juicy just there.
That's fantastic. I didn't know that. I've been using copper and for some time as a defence against slugs, but I didn't know that that was the case. I didn't know that they're magnetically sensitive.
Yeah.
You're actually sticking a flag in the ground saying,
oh, absolutely,
hey, look, new food. Yeah. I loved your idea that I read about on the website as well of stripping down some wire from a recent electrical installation, and then you're going to presumably put that around
the top of your raised beds.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so they're not going to climb up and over
so
the top.
So what's it been like for slugs this year? Because, of course, it's been mayhem.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the wet.
47 in one night, apparently.
Because it's the wet May, isn't it? If you get a wet May, they get to go out and party. And I've found balls of slug eggs in the garden. They're kind of the size of a tennis ball, aren't they? And all made
really
up of these.
Horrific.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not been a good year from that point of view. But, I mean, we had mega slugs here. I mean, a really huge slug problem. And I think we probably always will. But we don't get appreciable amounts of damage now. And I think that's partly because of using the copper tools. And the other thing that I found is that you can get organically approved slug pellets, which are based on ferrous phosphate. They degrade to iron in the soil. They don't harm anything. They're not harmful to birds or other plant life or insect life in the soil.
Yeah.
And the slugs don't just explode into nasty gooey messes. They discreetly kind of crawl away under a rock and disappear.
And I think that's really the trick with slugs. I mean, I think I caught a book from the Centre for Alternative Technology, which was something like 1,000 defences against slugs.
Yeah.
And it is a matter of doing as many of them as you can.
Oh, yeah.
Because each one of them just discourages them a little bit
more,
doesn't it?
We have slug patrols on wet evenings to pick them off the lawn before they make it up to the vegetable beds.
Yeah. What about the little keel slugs? Because I know the big slugs can eat prune stones and things like but people do say that the biggest menace is the tiny little ones.
The little ones are very destructive, they are.
And are they kept away as well?
They seem to be, yes. I mean, if we get a lot of rain, afterwards I will go out and I'll put a few of these organically approved ones that Garden Organics recommend. They're called Advanced Slug Killer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very careful to use as few as I can get away with as possible. And I notice that I'm doing it less and less often. So I think we're winning.
Yeah.
We're winning. But the other thing is, I think early on in the season, particularly if you've had things like cardboard and straw down to winterise and mulch your beds, it's very important in the weeks before you start sowing and planting that you actually go out and deal with your slug problem then, and not wait till it's got really bad and you've got stuff growing in the ground.
Yeah.
Because that's when they're really getting going. And
so you'd put maybe some of those slug pellets down on it before even you put anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and maybe a couple of weeks before I'm ready to plant, I'll go around and do that to make sure that it's as clean as it can be.
Yeah.
And I've tried all the other things. But there was a thing recently about beer traps, because lots of people will say, you know, beer traps are really good. Mm. But apparently they also trap and kill the beetles that eat the slugs.
Yes, I tried that. I found a slow worm in my beer trap once as well.
Yeah.
I accidentally found what appears to be a very interesting way of catching slugs in a garden, in one of the gardens that I'm staying near at the moment. I'd put out some plant pots, different sized black plant pots. There was a small black plant pot, a medium sized one, and a big one. And I'd just stack them on top of each other, so they're effectively freestanding, you know. Each plant pot didn't touch the next one down, like a Russian doll that doesn't fit properly. And when I went to tidy them up, they were just standing on the lawn outside the polytunnel, because I'd been doing a bit of transplanting. And when I went out the next day to tidy up, I picked up these plant pots, and every single one of them had loads of slugs in it.
Ah.
And they were different sized slugs in the different pots, because it's like they'd had sun on the pot. And so you seem to get different temperatures in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm now going to try that. I'm going to try putting them out more often and see how many more you can attract.
Yeah, that sounds really worth a try.
Yeah, because I did have to give up on the beer traps in the long run. It might be a good idea just to say a little bit about barrier protections generally about the fleeces. I was interested by your butterfly net, for example.
Mm. Yeah, this year I've been using what they call butterfly netting, and it's very heavy duty stuff. It lasts for years and years. You can buy it in a big roll and cut sizes that you want. And I've been using it as kind of just tied on vertical canes to keep the rabbits off around some of the beds, because rabbits are a problem, and over the top of things like brassicas that white butterflies are attracted to. And it's very good because you can actually see what's growing underneath it. Small pollinating insects can get through, because, you know, you often want those to for certain crops anyway. Whereas EnviroMesh keeps everything out.
Yep.
And then if you want to collect seed from your plants, you've got a big problem, because, you know, they won't actually be fertile.
Yeah.
So the butterfly netting I've found has actually worked really, really well.
It's a really good idea. Again, it's not something I'd come across before. Mm. I've used fleece and mesh before, but the butterfly netting looks like a good thing.
I think it's a really good option.
Yeah.
And it lets all the rain through nicely, you know, but it gives a certain amount of wind protection. But it's not so heavy that it crushes anything, so you can just lay it on top of certain things as well.
Yeah.
Although I tend to give it some support with hoops underneath, But yeah, I think that's been my biggest innovation this year, apart from the square meter approach.
I'm glad to be reminded of the square meter approach. I shall, because we'll be moving in on a new place soon, and I shall go straight for that. In fact, I think because you can always build more of them. You know, so. How are the fruit trees doing? Because being as it's so difficult to get holes and, you know, with your pick and stuff, how are they growing? And B, how are they doing in actually standing upright, you know, getting roots out?
They seem to be doing okay. We're also developing a small orchard on one part of the site, and we got a whole load of very old Welsh varieties from Bill Bleasdale over near Llanidloes. And he's... Welsh Mountain Orchards and Welsh Mountain Cider. Mm-hmm. And it's been in his family a long time. His father farmed apples in Somerset, so he knows a lot about apples. And what he's found is that, particularly in Wales, where he grows these apple trees on a slope at altitude, that what he recommends is that you don't fuss about with them, that you don't dig great big holes. He digs them up bare-rooted for you, as you want them. And he said, just put a spade in the ground, make a big slit, push the roots in, shove it back over with your boot and leave it. Don't even stake it.
So it's just like wild hedge planting.
Exactly.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And he said that actually they will be stronger and they will get going much, much more quickly and recover from being transplanted than any pot-grown stuff that you dig a great big hole for and you put a stake in.
So, that's great. Mm. That's great. So... Well, that's even if it gets windy after they've just been planted, because it seems a bit counterintuitive, doesn't it?
It does, but, you know, this is the way they grow in nature.
And also it means that apart from the slit, all of the soil around the roots is firm.
Yeah.
So as soon as roots go into that firm soil, they're getting firmness, whereas if you dig this big square hole that they recommend and spread the roots out amongst it, it's going to be a while before it encounters anything that it can anchor itself into, and presumably it's reluctant to root into it because it's happy with all the soft stuff with the food in it.
So I think that if you can get a tree that's been freshly dug up, bare rooted, and you can do it like that, it's probably good. If you buy it pot grown, then you really got to do what they say and dig the big hole and put the stake in. So, you know, it's two different approaches, and we're trying both of them.
Is it easy to get bare-rooted trees? That's a new idea for me as well.
Well, you have to get them, I think it's sort of October onwards, isn't it? Or November. November, probably. Yeah. They don't lift them until the tree goes dormant.
No, that's right.
Yeah. They're supposed to do a lot better than the pot-grown ones, certainly.
Oh, I'd like to try that as well. This has been very educational for me. It's great.
And when he talks about digging this slit, I can see why. Because when he digs them up, they tend to have very lateral roots.
Yeah.
Whereas the pot-grown ones, it's all in one place in the middle.
Yeah.
And they're not naturally good at sort of spreading out. It takes them a long time to adjust to that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the ones that come up bare-rooted are much more kind of natural and spready. So they're going to have a much bigger base anchor when you put them back in, providing you don't confine them to a little hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking about trees, you tried one of these Van Hoegel beds, didn't you?
The Hoegel bed.
Hoegel bed. How's that going?
They're really good now. I mean, it was very, very noticeable, the difference where we did that. Because we had this problem with the soil underneath not retaining the moisture, that the beds dried out really, really quickly. And they were the ones that we'd originally grown the potatoes in first, with the straw and everything. And I noticed how very, very dry that they got. And I read about this Hoegel bed approach. It simply means mound, actually. And you can do it even without having a bed that you're digging into. You can start a bed off this way as well. You put a load of rotten wood on the ground or in a pit, and you tip buckets of water over it, so it all soaks it up like a sponge. And the more rotten the wood is, the better, really. So you've got a nice big thick layer of this stuff.
And this is, of course, tree wood rather than building timber.
Tree wood. Rotting trees with, you know, bits of stuff that's been lying around with lots of nice sort of lichen and bits of yuck growing on it. All, you know, the more the better, really. And then you backfill it with either the stuff that you've dug out to start with, like we did, mixed with some other organic material, or you just build it up, you know, with like I was saying about growing the potatoes in a very small amount of compost with the straw and the cardboard and everything on top. And basically, the wood acts like a sponge, like a water reservoir. So if you've got very waterlogged soil, you could actually use this method for regulating that because it will soak and hold the moisture. So things won't be as sodden as they would otherwise be, for example, in heavy clay soil. Mm-hmm. But if you've got very free-draining soil that doesn't hold the water, then it will actually act like a sponge and hold it there and release it gradually into the bed to keep the soil moist. Also, it's rotting down over a very, very long period of time and adding nutrients to your soil. So you've actually got, a watering and feeding system actually in the bottom of the bed.
Presumably it's also fairly rich in bacteria and various...
Yeah. Lots of mycelium get going really, really quickly.
Microorganisms. Yeah. And you've noticed there's a noticeable difference.
Very noticeable difference, yeah.
Yes. Because again, I guess that with all of the water and soil disappearing, all of the life disappears as well.
Oh, totally,
and
yeah.
Really, it's not the soil that's doing the growing, is it? It's all the stuff that lives in there.
It's all the life inside it, So,
having gone, because how long have you been here now?
We've been here 5 years now. Well, and it's three years since I've been doing it the permaculture way.
It's really incredible. I mean, it's probably a year or so since I was here last, and I was here, I think, at the beginning of the year rather than the end, but it's looking amazing. There's an amazing amount of stuff growing out there.
Yeah.
And over time, presumably, the amount of work involved in this sort of gardening goes down.
Oh, yes.
And you're finding that once you've done all of the building and the stuffing and all of that and the installation of the rabbit defences and things, that you were saying that the actual maintenance of it's fairly light.
It's very small. I would say things like weeding. I do a little bit of weeding as and when necessary when I'm harvesting stuff, and that's really all I do.
Mm.
And it's amazing how little of it there is, because mostly the intensive planting restricts the amount of light falling on the soil, so you don't get the stuff germinating in the top layer. If the odd little bit comes up, it's easy enough to pull that out when you're just harvesting stuff because you can see it. Usually I put mulch on. If there is any exposed soil after I've harvested, then, for example, I used all the green tops off the parsnips I just pulled up, went straight back on to actually chopped up just as a green mulch on the exposed soil that was left. Mm-hmm. Where I dug the potatoes up, I just went with my bare hands through the compost and pulled them out, actually, the other day, early ones.
Yeah, lovely.
I got a nice big bag of shredded stuff from leaves and twiggy bits that I'd put through the shredder last year were all in a big sack. So I've just spread that on top as a mulch to stop weeds germinating in that and protect the surface of the soil from the elements.
Yeah, and it stops because, of course, we're now in the thistles are now in the farmer's fields. Yeah. The vast quantities of thistles are now going to seed, and it presumably stops the thistle seed sort of settling.
Yeah, it'll stop anything, because everything germinates in that top sort of inch or so of soil. So, if you actually keep that covered, then it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it keeps the moisture in, and it stops the extreme leaching out of nutrients and breakdown from sunlight and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it'll keep the life in the soil active until I want to plant something in that again.
Mm, brilliant. So when did you decide you were going to start trying to do a permaculture network?
Well, it was pretty soon after I'd done the course, actually. And the thing is, when you're on a course, you're with lots of other people. It's all very exciting. It's very supportive. You've got people to talk to about it, compare notes, ask questions. And all of a sudden, you're back on your own in your own garden and fairly isolated where we are. And you haven't got that anymore. And I thought it would be really nice to connect up with other people in the area who were interested in permaculture. And everybody I spoke to said, oh, well, yeah, I'm sure there's somebody I met, who was kind of interested in permaculture, but I don't know who they are or how to contact them or anything. And I thought, well, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but it would be really nice to actually link up with a few local people. And then I got asked to run a stall at a local green fair to give out some information on permaculture. And I thought, well, actually, maybe I could use that to launch the idea of people who are interested, kind of get in touch, and maybe we can, you know, sort of exchange information and that sort of thing. And before I knew where I was, I got inquiries from people over a very wide area. The word kind of got out through things like the FreeCycle Network, and people were saying, well, you know, I don't live in Rhaeadr, but I'd really like to be part of this. And it kind of got bigger and bigger. So by the time we actually launched, we were mid-Wales, not just Rhaeadr.
Yeah, it's and, a big area.
It's continued like that to the point where it's got so big. We've got a mailing list of over 600 people. And it gets networked by other transition groups and the Welsh Country magazine. And so it goes to, I would probably say, it goes to at least 1,000 people when we send something out. Which is huge compared to what I'd envisaged originally.
Yeah.
It then got to the point where I kept talking to people who were saying it'd be really nice if we had a proper Welsh arm of the UK Permaculture Association, because we're not covered by lots of things that they get grants for because of devolution. And, you know, we've got kind of very localised stuff, and we're a very rural area, and it would be really nice if we had a kind of cohesive bit under that UK umbrella, but we could do our own thing. So I threw that idea around with a few people, and it kind of gelled, and all of a sudden we were having a working group getting together with the head of the UK Permaculture Association to try and make this happen. And we launched last year as Permaculture Wales, and it's been growing since then. And they've finally settled on, I think they've settled on the final Welsh name for it.
I remember we were having a big talk about that, weren't we? Yeah, indeed.
It's because of, you know, how do you translate something for which there is no direct translation in Welsh?
No, something that's even difficult to explain in English.
Exactly.
Yes.
And what they seem to have come up with, they had a presence at the Eisteddfod recently, and they've talked to a lot of Welsh speakers about it, and they've come up with a word, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Paramaeth. It's Paramaeth, and the stress is on the second syllable. Paramaeth, yeah. I think, is how you pronounce it. Paramaeth Cymru. And it has to do with agriculture and kind of abundance and doing everything naturally, but it also has some kind of association with culture. And that's the tricky thing, because permaculture is to do with permanent agriculture and permanent culture.
Yeah.
And in English, it kind of means both things. And it's very difficult to get a Welsh word that actually does that. But everybody in Wales who's a Welsh speaker that they've talked to so far gets very excited about this new word. So that's this week. They've changed the Facebook page to it, even before it's completely official, because we need to get moving on that, really.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting, and I feel particularly excited about it, because it really all came out of having this idea about there being a local network, and then it getting bigger, and then it getting bigger, and now it's the whole of Wales.
Yeah, and all in such a short period of time. That's 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
This communications network, and presumably you're swapping seeds when you meet, and as well as information.
Seed swaps, and we cooperated with Transition Llandrindod last year to actually make a course happen for local people, and we had it over 6 weekends once a month, so 6 month course.
Yeah.
We imported the tutors to run it, and we got all the students together, and they were from all over the area and even slightly beyond.
And was it done on a site where they could get some physical experience?
Some of it was here, and some of it was at the site in Llandrindod that one of the organisers
has. I know the one,
So that was really good, because
that's
we had 23 people on the course.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. And it was groundbreaking for the tutors, who hadn't run a course in a modular way that way before. And now they're running them all over the place for other groups. So that started something as well, which was really nice.
It's great, isn't it? It's exactly what permaculture should be.
Mm.
Every little bit of it is turning out to be a seed of something that grows into something worthwhile.
Yeah.
Really fantastic.
So, it's expanded, you know, sort of beyond anything that I would have expected when I started. So.
And, I mean, the website's full of resources. I mean, you've got articles on perennial vegetables. There's recipes. I liked the cucumber and apple relish.
That's a good one.
Your quince and pippin jelly, and there's discussions on there about developing your inner permaculturalist and all of that.
Yeah.
So it's not all practical stuff. There's also some theoretical stuff, which brings me on really to your latest editorial, which I read just this morning, and I found it absolutely fascinating that there's some discussion now about whether we should be talking about the energetic human, about the human's inner garden, and developing that, what you call zone 00. And it seems that there's somebody out there who thinks that the permacultural thing should only be talking about that which is scientifically provable, I think is the word he uses.
Yeah, I think he's Australian. Not that that's a reason. he's obviously got a very different take on things, and actually there is a lot of scientific evidence, well-documented scientific evidence, to show the benefits of meditation and the effect it has on human systems. So, I really do think this guy needs to read a bit more before he makes those kind of pronouncements. But I'm sure, he's very, very good on all the permaculture stuff, but he's not quite into the kind of integral view of things that some of us are.
Yeah. Which is, of course, a reference to Ken Wilber's work. He's somebody that I'd like to do a show about at some point, because I really like Ken Wilber. I think he's got an extremely fine mind on him. A couple of things struck me about the comments that this man was making. I didn't make a note of his name, unfortunately. I made a note of Ken Wilber and his Integral University, and Joanna Macy and her Deep Ecology, both of whom I know about. But for a start off, since I read the article, some of the people I've mentioned it to have said I didn't know that permaculture had anything to do with science. And of course, it is more a culture than a science. And although horticulture is, shall we say, probably one of the oldest sciences on the planet, it's an anecdotal science. It's a science that's developed by thousands of individuals through their own experience in their own greenhouses, and then that's kind of exchanged. But I thought what was particularly striking about this man's comments was the fact that he seemed to think that scientifically provable was in some way valid. And of course, I've been putting across Rupert Sheldrake's science delusion, this idea that that anything that can't be proven, like telepathy, doesn't exist, that that only kind of scientific medicine works. And of course, actually, quantum science, quantum physics, has discovered that there is no such thing as objective science. Our materialist scientists are still behaving like it is objective, but they have discovered that it's not. So
The expectation of the experimenter affects the outcome of the experiment. I think that's a really big thing, and that is accepted in quantum science. People can bury their heads in the sand and try and ignore that all that if they want to, but
and just because you can't measure it doesn't mean to say it's not true either. So I mean, that's another thing I really like, is that it's now beginning to expand into some quite interesting areas, the Mid Wales Permaculture website, into ideas that surround it, because developing our own inner garden, I'm absolutely sure that your plants grow better when you're happy and relaxed. That gardening when you're stressed out is like cooking when you're stressed out. It doesn't work so well.
Although if you're stressed out, one of the best things to do is to actually go out in the garden and do stuff, because it really de-stresses you.
Again, you feel
de-stresses.
And another thing, of course, that I mean, because we exchange a lot, you send me a lot of links on the internet about other things that we've been talking about, and of course now you've been moving into links, although it's not, there is stuff, there's articles on the website about this as well, about the atmospheric geoengineering that's going on. You've had some, I think, really groundbreaking articles on that, because they're so, you manage to find ones that are really compact, you know, and are you finding other things that you're likely to be exploring along those lines?
Yeah, a while back I did put a small article on the website about things like the geoengineering, and what you might loosely term earth changes, I suppose, have come to be categorised as earth changes. And earth changes is a very wide field, because it's to do with climate change, geological change, seismic activity, solar activity. and all the kinds of things that seem to be affecting our planet, our climate, our weather, and what's going on, really. And I suppose we can't really avoid mentioning 2012 because it is a big deal and it is talked about a lot. There's quite a lot of, shall we say, way out stuff to be found on the internet to do with that. But it's come to prominence. Even the other night there was a feature on the television about Mexico and it's how it's had a lot of investment and how actually it's pulled itself around from very difficult situation to become much more prosperous than it had been. And even on this very mainstream program, the issue of the 2012 thing and the Mayan prophecies apparently came up, and people in Mexico knew about it, but they weren't necessarily that bothered because they didn't necessarily see 2012 as a sort of doom and gloom thing and the end of the world and everything as we know it. They saw it at the end as the end of a cycle and the beginning of a new one.
Mm.
And I think that that's probably how we ought to be viewing it. But the more I investigate, the more material I come across, that it's very stimulating to think about these issues because it involves consciousness and ethics and our inner development on what you might call a metaphysical plane, as well as very practical things to do with climate change and possible, well, we know that the Earth's poles are shifting and there's lots of scientific evidence for the breakdown of the magnetic fields around the Earth and them becoming destabilised. And
changes in the nature of the transmissions from the sun as well. Changes in the nature of light.
We're approaching solar maximum next year. We've never lived through a period of this kind of solar activity before where we are so dependent on things like satellite communications, for example. Because in the past, you know, 20-something years ago, when we last had a maximum this big, we weren't so dependent on those things. And we know that scientists and engineers are very concerned about what will happen to things like power grids on Earth if we get a direct CME, coronal mass ejection, that knocks everything out. And it completely undermine the foundations of how modern society works.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are very big considerations in all this. We know there's an earthquake uptick ongoing at the moment. Professor Bill Maguire recently did a lecture at Aberystwyth University. He's actually one of the members of SAGE, which is that Disasters Emergency Committee that meets with the government. And we're just reading his book, Waking the Giant, at the moment, which is all to do with things like climate change and the relationship with earthquakes and volcanic activity, and looking at events from the past where volcanic activity caused major, major problems and interfered with the climate even more. So, you know, all those things are actually very pertinent. They're part of our environment. They're part of how Earth works within a wider context, and they're going to affect people, let alone, you know, all the stuff we know about to do with economic collapse being imminent and the dollar and the Eurozone crisis and all those things.
Yeah.
And all that is to do with trying to live with growth on a finite planet with finite resources. And that really brings us back to the crux of permaculture, is, you know, you actually can't run a planet like that. If we all lived like the Americans, we'd need 8 Earths to support us. We know it's untenable. That's without all these other things going wrong and the problems being probably caused by geoengineering entering the mix as well. So, you know, people and the planet are facing a very, very difficult time ahead. And what I have found is that more and more people are kind of waking up to this and wanting answers, wanting also kind of contact with other people who are thinking about these issues, because very often they feel quite isolated because they can't talk to their friends and family about it because people are either freaked out or in denial.
Yeah.
Do not want to know. Mm. Think it's all conspiracy theory stuff. Say, well, I can't do anything about it anyway. And they want to bury their heads in the sand. And those people who are waking up to it and wanting answers and wanting to know what they can do, either, you know, to help themselves, their families, their communities, to be more prepared, to be more resilient, and to provide more local food security, and to really have some idea of what we're actually dealing with here. Those people need information and they need support. And so increasingly large amounts of my time are spent contacting other people, listening to other people, looking very critically at stuff that appears on the internet, because you really got to sort the wheat from the chaff here a lot of the time.
I hugely appreciate the links you send me, because of all my other stuff that I do on the internet, I don't have the time to do the stuff you're doing, and the links you send me are really quite stunning.
So, yeah, that I feel that that's become quite a big part of what I'm doing. I don't necessarily talk about that a lot on the website, but increasingly we are getting more kind of mainstream articles going on that do refer to it. And I think it's a question of informing people without unnecessarily alarming people, and enabling people to perhaps face a very uncertain future with more information and more preparedness than they otherwise might have.
Yeah.
And I do feel that that really is right in there with permaculture. And I don't find any kind of conflict of interest in that myself.
No. I was really pleased to see the geoengineering items on the website, because, of course, we've been aware of it for a long time. In fact, it's been amazing that people manage to stay in denial when you can see it in front of you every day.
Yeah.
To me, it seemed like it was just seeing it in a permaculture website was starting to see it break out from the apparent, mad furry beasties that are there, kind of.
I think it's difficult for people in the UK because they're not used to seeing the kind of extreme things that people in America have been used to seeing for a long time. The new film, Why in the World Are They Spraying, is actually out today. It's just been released, and I started watching it actually before you arrived. I haven't watched all of it yet. It's absolutely brilliant. It's got all the real scientific studies, all the real experts talking on it, and I think anybody watching that would be convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that this is going on. We know that China and Russia also have the technology to mess about with the weather big time. The Chinese have boasted about it often enough. They tend not to keep it under such wraps. And sooner or later, it's going to start affecting us and parts of Europe that have been mercifully free from it most of the time. When things get to the stage they are now in America, I can't imagine anybody not realising that it's actually happening. We're even starting to notice, I think, here with our microgeneration records over the last 3 years, that the amount of sunlight we're getting is dropping and dropping and dropping, and that has also part of what they've been actually measuring in America. Now, it may be that a lot of what is going on, apart from to do with commercial vested interests, is to do with experimentation about controlling the weather in an effort to prevent further global warming. So it could be that there are some factions within the scientific establishment in these other places that think that, what they're doing is actually justified.
Yeah.
Some of us are inclined to think there is more to it than that, and it is not the only reason that they're doing it. But even if that is what they are hoping to do, and that a lot of this is experimentation to try and get to grips with controlling the weather, the damage that they're doing and the amount of nanochemicals that are actually being found in the hail and the snow and the rain and are coming drifting back down to earth and causing major health problems with millions of people is actually really, really serious. And I think that it's very, very important that we wake up to this as yet another form of ecocide. And ecocide is a campaign that, I have a lot to do with because of being involved with permaculture. And it's basically trying to get crimes against the planet and nature being internationally outlawed in the way that genocide is. And I think that geoengineering, because of all these dangers, not just to do with messing with the climate, but also putting all these nanoparticles of things like aluminium and phosphates.
We've got a list here from Perlinghieri saying saying that there's barium, which is like arsenic and damages the heart. There's fiberglass coated with nano aluminium, which damages brain function. There's radioactive thorium, cadmium, chromium, nickel, desiccated blood, mold spores, yellow fungal mycotoxin, ethylene dibromide, which is an agricultural pesticide, which we were just talking about earlier, polymer fibres. All of that is known to be in this kind of chemical mix they're putting up there.
And if we take this into our bodies, it becomes, because it's nanoparticles, becomes integrated into our cellular structure. So, yeah, it's extremely very scary and bad news. And I think we need to be as informed as possible and not to just react from the kind of fear and denial, which is understandable. Because, you know, once you get into this rabbit hole and you start seeing all these things, it can be very, very difficult to maintain normal activities, normal conversations, normal relationships and normal thinking, because the brain rebels against it. You know, of course it's scary and of course it's, we don't want to believe it's happening, and it would be much easier just to dismiss it as conspiracy theories or, you know, kind of flaky thinking or pseudoscience or any of those things, because that's a natural reaction for a lot of us, you know, to actually not be able to cope with it mentally at all. And we have to find some way of blocking it out. And I fully understand why people do react that way, and I sympathise with it. I think what I see my job is as providing a level of information that allows an entry point for more comfortable thinking about it and support for those people who already are thinking about it and finding it extremely lonely down here in the rabbit hole.
Well, I think that's a brilliant aspect of it, because, like you say, permaculture is not just about growing things, it's about designing systems that work and are sustainable.
Yeah.
And this does not look like a workable, sustainable solution.
No. And we have to sustain people as well. We have to have a framework that actually supports people to be able to cope and carry on functioning and be able to try and design their own solutions and possibly unite as a voice where a pressure group reaction is needed.
I think one of the things we've realised in the kind of lawful and legal work that's going on is that solo action doesn't work. People are just having their legs cut from under them every time. And we're all now starting to work towards large representative actions where several million people get together to have a go, and that's probably, this is an aspect of the same thing. On the business of helping people to support each other, finally, of course, some people will probably remember your name turning up on the Dr. Rock show before, because I've talked about your idea for very small local networks.
Yes.
In terms of kind of local support in the valley here and things. How did that work?
It's kind of worked up to a point. We threw the idea out among our very local residents here. And everybody that I spoke to at the beginning said, oh, what a brilliant idea. That's really, really good. We've used it a few times since to get information out to people about things like micro-generation meetings for farmers that they might not otherwise know about, you know, where they can get help and funding to achieve things. We've helped people with things like collecting prescriptions or getting other things done where they've not been well or not been able to drive. We've circulated information about mysterious piles of rubbish appearing in our lane. We've talked about lost animals, you know, that have got out from somebody's field, that kind of thing. And the latest one was I had some information from one of our network members locally about the dangers of smart meters.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that's a really important one.
Very shocking.
Yeah, totally. And I think most people, if they know about the word smart meters, they tend to think, oh, it's something that you have installed that helps you reduce your energy use because it shows you what you're using. But this isn't what they're talking about at all. And it's very, very worrying. Apparently, they started installing them in Llanidloes. If people don't know and they're sold the idea that their utility company wants to put these in because it will make their life easier because they won't have to have a meter man or phone their readings in and it'll all be taken care of, they might think, oh, this is a good idea. But actually, these things put out huge amounts of microwaves, not just like your cell phone, but more like the kind of local TV phone cell mast, where it puts out these enormous pulses of microwaves at frequent intervals, like, you know, sort of regularly throughout a 24-hour period. And they can cause all kinds of problems with mental processes, cancer, all headaches, all kinds of immune system problems.
And that's without even mentioning whether you actually want your utility suppliers to know exactly when and where and how you're using your electricity or
because
whatever.
Apparently they can, in America, they've been using these things and passing information onto third parties about when people are in the house, what they use, so it can show when you're not there, for example, which leaves you wide open.
Yeah.
And it also is given to people to try and sell you insurance and other goods, and it's a real invasion of personal privacy. So I think, you know, on health grounds and privacy grounds, it's something we should absolutely stand up and reject.
Mm.
And it's very difficult because in more suburban and urban neighbourhoods where you're very close to other people, if you don't have one and the next door neighbour does, or even somebody just up the road, you're going to be affected by it.
Or if everybody's got them, if they turn up, if you get instruments like that in every, because of course on a lot of the modern houses they put the electricity meters on the outside. And I saw a YouTube vid from America where they turned up because this lady's meter was outside and they turned up to change it and she told him to go away and he wasn't having any of it. And she pulled a gun on him in the long run, chased him off with a gun. And of course we can't do that. No. We're going to need to use administrative means to stop this.
And what they're recommending on this Stop Smart Meters website is that you actually put a notice on your meter, because if they come when you're not there, they could change it. And you have to put a notice on saying that they're not allowed to and you don't want it. Otherwise, they could just do it. So, yes,
we actually recommend no trespass messages on everybody's gate because it keeps people out the gate.
Yeah.
They are trespassing if they walk past the no trespass sign. And if they stay there when you've asked them to leave, they're committing aggravated trespass.
Yeah.
So, but that boils down to the same point, but wider, really. But, yeah, notices on them saying that you're not allowed to remove them, especially if they're outside your house.
Yeah. So this is something that we just sent round to everybody on our very local network.
Yeah.
And we've got a kind of buddy system going so that those people who are not on the internet, and there are a few, have got a neighbour who will undertake to print stuff out and take it round to them to make sure that they're not left out.
Brilliant.
So I think that's important.
So it's sort of maintaining a momentum, is it?
Yeah, and I think, though it hasn't been much used yet, if things get very difficult, I mean, even if we all get snowed in like we had been for 5 weeks at a time in previous winters, that sort of thing can actually become a really big issue.
Yeah.
And it's often easier for people to put a general request out that I can then get round for assistance than it would be for them to ring up specific people and say, well, can you do this? Because people often feel a bit reticent about that.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a general appeal, I can put it out and anybody who can help can then respond.
Maybe several people will.
Yeah, so, you know, we envisage it as putting in place a system that people get used to knowing is there. They may not use it much at the moment, but if times get tough, then they'll know it's there and they'll feel more able to use it.
Great.
So, that you know, we're just sort of starting with small beginnings. And actually that idea has been then got around lots of other places and publications. I think New Leaf Hereford put it out. Various other sustainability websites have picked up on it and put it out as well.
Well, it seems like you're a real inspiration, Ros. I mean,
I don't mind. It's permaculture that's the inspiration.
I suppose so, but I mean, it's starting all these things, you know. It's a real pleasure to know you and to receive links and see what you're doing. And I'm ever so grateful.
You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. That was me in discussion with Ros Brown, founder of the Mid Wales Permaculture Network and permaculturewales.co.uk. I found that personally a very educational conversation. Every time I go to Roz's place, I see more stuff that gives me more ideas and teaches me more things. And like I say, I personally think she's a prime example of how much difference one person can make when they set about dealing with nature as they find it, shall we say. It was a real pleasure. So thanks to Roz for that. So we heard from Roz how she managed to take hold of a piece of ground which really was not willing to cooperate. It was very difficult to hold on to water into it. Most things weren't rooting into it. And most of her first year's worth of gardening just kind of shriveled once it was moved out of any protection it had in its early years. And that permaculture effectively transformed the place. It really is very verdant now. There's many, many different things growing together. She's practicing all manner of different techniques which can come together under the one label. But I think fundamentally one of the things that she said came about as a result of her permaculture course was that she decided to stop fighting the site and to work with it. So rather than trying to impose just her own will, she started looking at what was going on the ground. And as she said, using weeds, for example, as an indicator of what might grow there and where it might grow. And slowly but surely built up a community of plants which, if you like, cooperate with each other. They live genuinely in a community and are helping each other out. One of the most recent things that's been done at the place is the establishment of what is a ditch, really. I can't remember the official name for it. It does have a proper label. But the idea of the ditch is to try and catch some of the water that's running over the hard surface of the hill and down into the garden and keep it there for a bit, and then eventually it can seep into the rest of the ground that's below rather than running really quickly off. And this has been, I think, tremendously successful because the actual ditch itself where the water is has become a real haven for wild plants. There's all manner of things growing in there, such that the thing itself may be used for different purposes in the future and more of the water catching places built. But it is down to a careful co-mingling of all of the different areas of the garden. Rather than being kind of a bunch of separate things, it is actually a kind of whole in itself, and all of the boundaries between one thing and another really, really kind of benefit each other. And that's one of the basic principles, actually, is to use edges and value the marginal. One of the first things I learned from permaculture is that the margins, the places, the transitional places in between one environment and another are the places where the most growth and the most variety actually occur. So out there in nature, there's different plants living next to each other. They extract different minerals from the ground and they reach different depths where they find different things. And they supply these minerals to all of the plants that are around them each autumn when their leaves fall or whatever other vegetative decay occurs. All of these minerals are kind of re-delivered to the soil. So they're brought up from deep below and then dropped on top. And of course, many plants do this year after year after year, growing leaves, then drawing up nutrients and then dropping them on the ground. And it very quickly yields quite a fertile growing ground for all the other things. One classic example of this is using comfrey around your apple trees. So you plant a deep-rooted plant like comfrey round roughly where the branches extend to. And the apple tree itself is fairly shallow rooting, the comfrey is deep rooting. And so it draws up the minerals, which can then, as the comfrey dies back or is cropped by human beings to kind of intensify things a little, is delivered to the top of the soil and then washed back down again by the rain, making it available for the apple tree. In the meantime, it's fungi and bacteria that kind of convert all this dead material into a form that's actually absorbable by roots. But at the same time, whilst the plants are still living and green before they deliver all of this stuff to the soil, the plants themselves are supplying energy, the energy needs of the fungi and the bacteria. So there's a kind of mutually beneficial relationship, a little bit of biofeedback. Everything's feeding everything else. It's that ancient alchemical symbol of the Ouroboros, the snake eating its own tail, which is symbolic in alchemy of matter transformed, but it also represents the eternal cycle of nature, the fact that something feeds on something else and grows up and dies back, and then itself becomes food for the next generation. It's sort of similar way that insects feed off flowers, and at the same time they're pollinating plants for future seeding and future flowers. Once again, there's a kind of mutual dance going on here. It's not a question of one thing preying upon another. On even more subtle levels, many plants give off chemicals, like aromatic herbs are a good example. And these chemicals, these I suppose, ejections, if you like, can be useful and beneficial to neighbouring plants. They can also do things like send out emergency signals that attract pests just to one that chooses to kind of sacrifice itself whilst the others might survive. Like I said earlier, forest garden kind of mimics or facilitates this kind of process, which starts occurring naturally when, as Ross suggested, you stop fighting with the site that you're on and start actually working with it. Another thing I thought was good about Ross's conversation was that one of the things they tried was to give people a practical experience as a result of their encounter with permaculture, and as their decision was to publicise the idea of a thing called square foot gardening, which I'm pretty sure I've spoken about before, where a small bed is made that is 3 foot or 4 foot by 4 foot, 3 foot by 3 foot or 4 foot by 4 foot, and then can be divided into little 6-inch squares, and then things can be sown in those squares, like a few beetroot or a cabbage or a tomato plant. And it means that the inexperienced gardener can become aware of what's likely to come up in a place and be able to start recognising the plants that are not required. And so it introduces them to the things they do want as well as the things they don't. It's an intensive form of gardening which allows you to supply a continuous stream of veg for a large part of the year. Which will be enough to feed at least a couple of people, I would have thought, for major part of their vegetable needs anyway. And that was tremendously successful. Got out there to a thing called the Spring Greens Fair in Hereford, put out some leaflets explaining how to do this, and many people hopefully went out and tried it. It's also a really good way of being able to put in a relatively small amount of work, because vegetable gardening on a larger scale is a bit of a challenge, and one can learn about all of the challenges and the successes and things in a small area before exerting too much energy. It allows a lot of experimentation to happen at very little kind of personal energetic cost. Basically, permaculture practitioners are, as I said earlier, trying to design a system in which the brains of the human are used to maximize mutually beneficial connections. Really, it's not a question of how many species there are, or it's more a question of how well integrated the species that are there are with each other. So it's a question of developing as many mutually beneficial connections in infrastructure and plants as possible. And the idea is that planting the right things next to the right things and making sure that human intervention and human bits in between are also suitably integrated really leads to a kind of benefit for everything that's living in the neighbourhood. And as one of my favourite books on the subject is by a chap called Patrick Whitefield, and it's called Permaculture in a Nutshell. It really is a very small book and covers many, many really brilliant things in it. And he sums it up beautifully, I think. He says the aim is to use the power of the human brain applied to design to replace human brawn and fossil fuel energy and the pollution that goes with it. And of course, we're talking there not only, as it turns out, about agriculture and horticulture growing vegetables. We could also be talking about community. There is only a little bit of this show left over, though, so I'm going to have to go into that aspect of things probably in a later date when I've got somebody else to talk to about that specific aspect of it, how it is that this technique, as it were, spreads way beyond simply plants or food supplying systems into all the other things that a community can do. In fact, all community-based systems can become permacultural, and there's a lot of background information on the internet as to how this happens. And some of it's been really, really well systemized, really well described to give the kind of feeling for it. But really, at the heart of permaculture is a fundamental desire to do what we believe to be right and to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. This is what Whitefield says. In other words, there's a sense of ethics, which in permaculture can be summed up as earth care, people care, and fair shares. And those are, I think, really great guiding principles. Roz mentioned them as well. Really, the earth care boils down to enlightened self-interest, the notion that we humans must look after the earth and all our living systems because we depend on them for survival, if for no other reason. People care means trying to replace both the drudgery of traditional, what are called peasant farming, and fossil fuels, trying to replace both of those with the use of intelligent design, putting our effort in at the beginning to study the environment that we're trying to build in and try and include as much advantage as we possibly can from the conclusions that we draw. But we need to be able to work on the people as well. There's all the fear and all of the frustration that's being presented to us at the moment. Alongside the earth care, we really got to try and help people to become part of the system that they've become divided from, if you like, if we're going to stand any chance of establishing sustainable human habitats. And the fair shares, I mean, the earth can only survive in a healthy state if we match our consumption to what we actually need to take, rather than for greed for what is being suggested to us. And it means leaving plenty of space for other environments, for other species, leaving enough resources for all the other peoples of the world, and of course a clean and well stocked planet for future generations. And this all boils down to a system that we're really very used to talking about. Whitefield points out that the field of population control is complicated. The field of population growth, rather, population control is of course even more complicated. But he brings up an example of Ladakh in northern India, which, as many places in India, was until quite recently still reliant on local trading networks and actually meeting its needs from its immediate locale and its local resources. And whilst that was going on, the population was stable and more or less in harmony with the environment that it lived in. And I was speaking with a lady from India about just this the other day, and it has disappeared quite recently from India. But the kind of community-based farming in some way seemed to make sure that the population restrained itself or was restrained by forces which I'm sure could be further identified and developed. But as soon as the Indian state introduced a cash economy, the Ladakhis, instead of relying on their own kind of resource, were now dependent on resources from a long way off. And access to those resources was determined, broadly speaking, by access to what is loosely called money. And so with no need to keep the population steady, it started increasing. So all of the development that's happening in the north and south aims to entice people into the cash economy and replace local production for local needs and long-distance trade. All of that is incredibly energy expensive. And this idea that just in a small patch of land, you can grow a bigger variety of things and in a more healthy environment than you'd ever stand a chance of doing in a field full of a monocrop is really important. It means that every single little bit of difference we make is a difference that counts. So in the end, permacultural design principles need to be combined with a sort of deep local knowledge, which is fast disappearing, but it hasn't disappeared yet. In fact, the business, as we heard last week when we were talking to Mel and Sinkra about foraging for herbs and for food out in the countryside, more and more people are becoming interested in knowledge which is otherwise fairly rapidly disappearing. But it is still possible to mix these kind of design principles, this idea of things getting on with other things, with local knowledge that is still extant. So there's also it's also the time to talk to other people to find out what the previous generations know, because they do know solutions. There are solutions amongst us. More and more people are interested and they're spreading more and more quickly. And people are starting to operate in sympathy with their local ecosystems rather than fighting with them. And this approach ultimately will at least provide for more food, more medicines, more fibers, and even perhaps a little bit of cash crop even from a small area of land. And in a nation or nations where food is rapidly disappearing from the countryside and being replaced by communications masts and windmills and thistles, this can only help. Every single one of us choosing changes the way the world becomes. And only by reconnecting with our local resources are we going to move towards a sustainable society. And I really recommend permaculture as a literally grassroots approach to that. There's a little bit that everybody can do.